Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Welcome to The Body Show. Each week we talk about health and fitness, but none of what we discuss replaces a visit to your own primary care provider. Now, October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and today we're talking about breast cancer. It touches all of us. If you have a loved one, a sister, a wife, a mother, a daughter, a cousin, you name it, you could go on and on, because 1 in 8 women will develop this in their lifetime. Early detection is still seen as the key to more successful treatment and hopes for a cure. Now, we do know that breast cancer happens in men as well, much rarer, but it is a possibility. So really, there's nobody who I could think of that this might not touch. And so breast cancer awareness being the topic of October, we're going to be talking about it again today. Last week, we had a best of show during the pledge drive, and we also heard a little bit about breast cancer as well. Now, it's not just about the mammogram. There's other options out there. And if you are diagnosed with breast cancer, what comes next? Well, we've got some experts here. We're going to be talking with a board-certified radiologist and medical director of Polymomy Women's Center, specializing in breast radiology. That's going to be Dr. Greg Dunn. Here in the studio, I have Dr. Irmina Van Dyken, and she is a specialist in oncoplastic breast surgery, which is a term we're going to define in just a few minutes. But before that, we're going to hear a little bit about nutrition. Just so happens we have Dr. Colin Campbell on the line, and he's definitely a proponent of how what you eat really makes up what you are and your risk factors for various health diseases. Dr. Campbell, welcome to The Body Show.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you. Just before we came on, I was just talking with Dr. Van Dyken, and she said, you know, she's a big proponent, and everyone else will hear this in a few minutes, about medical nutrition and how that can have a huge impact on not only the initial diagnosis, but also recurrence rates of things like breast cancer. Now, you're going to be giving some unique lectures as part of the Vegetarian Society, but you also have some thoughts and some science behind how what you, God, you know, that old phrase, you are what you eat. It just comes back to get you every time. Tell us a little bit about how you feel nutrition affects overall health and well-being.
Well, I've been in the business now for, actually, this is my 59th year. I'm a researcher scientist, essentially a professor at Cornell University. Over the years, I learned something about nutrition that I never thought I would be saying, basically. But it's really all based on really good science, I think, and published extensively, and it comes down to a question concerning the kind of foods we actually consume and the range of effects that it can have. I'm really talking about a food, a diet that I call a whole food, plant-based diet. That doesn't necessarily mean vegan, and it doesn't necessarily mean vegetarian, because the vegan practice too often is too much fat in the diet, and too much refined carbohydrates, and vegetarians, they tend to use, 90% of people at least tend to use dairy. So I'm talking about basically fruits, vegetables, grains, whole grains. And what we now can do is actually literally cure heart disease. For example, in fairly advanced stages, we can reverse type 2 diabetes with food better than you can do it with drugs. And as long as people continue to do that, it's not a one-time treatment. When they get onto this and get used to it, and amazing things happen. Cancer is where my specialty was, and early on we learned in our research, and it involved a lot of research over many, many years, we learned that we could actually turn on experimental cancer, make it grow, by feeding protein in excess of the amount we need. And quite frankly, about 95% of our population uses protein in excess of what we need, usually in the form of consuming it as animal food. I mean, most people think that protein is basically meat, if you will, but there's plenty of protein, plenty enough protein in plants alone. We don't need to consume rich sources of protein such as with meat and milk and eggs.
So
that's really what turns on cancer.
Well, let's talk about an average person. An average person, average weight, and if they wanted to know how much protein can I get from salad? Let's say they definitely want to prevent cancer. They may not have it now. They want to prevent heart disease and diabetes. How much protein should somebody be getting, and how much lettuce and spinach do they need to eat to get that?
Well, first off, they shouldn't be asking the question. because it's really quite irrelevant. If we're consuming a whole food, plant-based diet, there's plenty of, you know, whole vegetables, grains, fruits, and so forth and so on. The body takes care of it itself. I mean, we've really got caught up in this paradigm of trying to quantitate everything and figure out exactly how many grams of this, that, and something else. That's really quite misleading, it turns out, because the amount of protein we consume from a plant-based diet is around 8-10% of total calories. That's plenty enough. That's been known for 75 years. People haven't paid attention to it. But so we only need around 10-11%, maybe 8-12% or something like that, total protein. And if we just eat that kind of food, we don't need to think about the numbers. In reality, what most of us do, though, is consume a lot of animal-based foods. And so we're not around 10% or so of protein. We're up around 17-18%, which is far too much. And that causes a lot of problems. So I never myself, in all these years I've been in nutrition research, I never sit down and actually calculated how much of the nutrients I consume myself. It's a kind of return to nature, letting nature take care of things.
Well, let's talk about a return to nature, kind of perfect dietary day. What sort of foods do you eat that make up the whole foods, plant-based fruit, vegetables, and grains? What would be an example? It's around dinner time now. What would somebody be eating for dinner if they followed the whole food plant-based diet?
Well, first off, they ought to emphasize the consumption of the colored vegetables, you know, obviously greens, leafy greens, and any kind of vegetable that really has a good deal of color in it. Same is true for fruit, because the chemical that imparts color to these foods is also the kind of chemical that basically acts as an antioxidant. And it's a good idea to consume those foods rich in antioxidants, which, as I say, means fruits and vegetables and so forth and so on. We also need a source of energy, obviously. And usually grains are used by most people. That includes rice and various kinds of grains. And we also can use tubers. And I know that's a popular thing in Hawaii, serves the population quite well. So we can use tubers or grains as a source of primarily the energy. And when we're eating food like that, the fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, of course, we get everything that we need. In fact, we get it in ideal amounts. I sound maybe kind of vague, you know, in a sense, but it really does work. It just does amazing things. In 10 days' time, if people would try this diet, in 10 days' time, we can see a precipitous drop in blood cholesterol levels, for example, which is associated with heart disease risk. We can see changes in blood pressure for those who have problems that way. We can see changes in body weight just in 10 days.
So
don't add back a lot of salt, sugar, and fat. That's also part of the equation.
So if people want to hear more about taking the 10-day diet, if they want to find a little bit more about trying this to see if they can see some changes in their own numbers, where can they find out more information?
Well, we have information on our own website. And some of my colleagues have, too. Our website is nutritionstudies.org. That's one place. But then there's Dr. Shintani, Terry Shintani there in Hawaii, along with Dr. Ruth Heydrich. I think they have a radio station of their own. Dr. Shintani has been at this for a long time. He has a medical degree as well as a law degree and a public health degree. And he's really excellent. He can tell you a lot about that. You know, you can go to the various society websites. Dr. John McDougall, who used to practice there in Hawaii some years ago, now in Santa Rosa for the last two or three decades. Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. You know, there's quite a bunch of us right now in the profession who have websites where people can find this. But then there's a lot of other people, too. This movement actually is developing quite rapidly. It's very exciting.
Well, and it's good news for all of us. And so if people want more information, then it looks like they can maybe go to nutritionstudies.org. We are all very familiar with Shintani's diet. That's been quite a hit here in the islands. And so it sounds like there's a lot of great places where we can really hear more about the movement to make what we eat much healthier so that we can have better health outcomes and less medical problems. So I want to thank you for joining us on the show today. We're going to go and delve into our topic of breast cancer and hit some highlights on how nutrition can actually affect that. But thanks for being on today and sharing your insights.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Now, next, we're going to talk about breast cancer. Dr. Campbell brought up some interesting thoughts on how what you eat really can affect your health. And we do know that there are a lot of different foods out there that we love to eat that taste good, might not be that good for us, and they may be a risk for having problems, including things like cancer. So how do we know if we've developed cancer or not? If you're a woman and you're over 40, or in some cases, if you have a family history and risk factors and you need to be extra careful, doing mammograms is one of the ways that you can find out if you happen to have a risk for breast cancer. But it's more than just mammograms. If you have a mammogram done, there's some other techniques out there, ultrasound, MRI, etc. And you never know exactly which one is what you need to do for your particular situation. So talk about an opportunity. We have got Dr. Gregory Dunn. He is one of the board-certified radiologists at Polymomy Women's Center, and he specializes in breast radiology and breast cancer detection. And he's on the line to share what's the latest with automated whole breast ultrasound and why it might take a greater role in the diagnosis of breast cancer. Dr. Dunn, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi, Dr. Kozak. Thanks for having me.
Automated whole breast ultrasound. A lot of people don't know what that is. What is it and when is it used?
So automated whole breast ultrasound, or AWBUS, A-W-B-U-S, is a screening ultrasound exam. It's similar to a mammogram in that the patients are asymptomatic. They don't have, you know, any lump that they feel or any pain in their breasts or anything like that. Totally asymptomatic, you know, walking, talking, totally fine. But they're coming in for a screening exam to check to see if they might have a breast cancer hiding in their breast somewhere. Ultrasound is complementary to mammogram in the sense that ultrasound uses a sort of a complementary or a different technique to detect these cancers using sound waves instead of X-ray. And by in doing so and complementing mammograms, we can actually potentially detect more cancers with the combination of both mammogram and ultrasound.
So you're not suggesting that the ultrasound would replace the mammogram, but it would be used in addition.
That's correct. Right.
There's something unique about the automated whole breast ultrasound that's a little different than the types of ultrasound we've been using thus far. What's new about it, and why is it potentially going to be even better?
So automated whole breast ultrasound is basically, it's a technique to scan the entire breast. And it uses a machine or a device that allows scanning to make sure that we don't miss any portion of the breast. It also includes the area under the arm, the axilla, which is where a lot of our lymph nodes that drain the breast, about 75% of the breast is drained by the axillary lymph nodes. And this scan would also include the axillary nodes to make sure that there aren't any abnormal-looking axillary nodes in that region. As the scan is being performed, these scans are overlapping one another to ensure that we don't miss any part of the breast. And that's what's different from manual ultrasound. Most ultrasound of the breast is done manually by a technologist who quickly scans over the area of the breast of interest. Automated whole breast ultrasound uses both manual and automated techniques so that a machine ensures that we don't miss any part of the breast. So that's probably the biggest difference.
So if someone were to be told they need to do an ultrasound after they've had a mammogram and maybe there's an area that needs to be further defined, this would be the type of technique that would help them to get a better picture of what's going on?
Actually, the AWBUS, the automated whole breast ultrasound, is performed more in the screening setting. So those patients that don't have any findings either on their mammogram or any clinical complaints, any symptoms like a lump that I mentioned before. These patients are asymptomatic, don't have any symptoms at all. If there is a finding on a mammogram and you want it evaluated further, that's actually when the manual diagnostic ultrasound comes into play, and those are more that's a more important study and tool to identify and characterize the lesion that was seen on the mammogram, or a symptomatic complaint like a lump and that sort of thing. So it kind of depends on the situation. If the patient, again, is asymptomatic, that's when the automated whole breast ultrasound comes into play. If they do have a symptom or if there is a finding on the screening mammogram, then the diagnostic ultrasound would be the study of choice.
Now,
so
you
there
mentioned
is a slight difference.
Sure, and you mentioned that they're complementary. So would women ever be asking for the ultrasound instead of the mammogram?
You know, we have actually had some requests for ultrasound. Oftentimes, or some situations, as you might imagine, it's for patients that don't like breast compression from a mammogram, because in order to do a mammogram, you have to have the machine compress the breast, and some patients are very sensitive. It's just very uncomfortable for them, and they just want to have an ultrasound done. However, the ultrasound is complementary, and it does not replace a mammogram. So we actually don't recommend doing ultrasound only, but rather, if you're going to do ultrasound, do it in addition to the screening mammogram.
So really, there's a select particular population that would benefit from this, and if it is indicated for them, then it's now available through Polymomi Medical Center.
Correct. And actually, if I can just add one thing to that, there is a select population that the automated whole breast ultrasound is particularly useful for, and those are the patients with dense breasts. You may be familiar with the new law that was enacted on January 1st of this year, where all imaging facilities that perform mammograms have to notify patients now of dense breast tissue. So there's actually four different categories of breast tissue density, but the first two and the last two are sort of clumped together. And so you have fatty breasts or dense breasts, just to simplify things. And if a patient has dense breasts, they're not only at slightly increased risk of developing a breast cancer, but probably even a higher chance of missing a breast cancer that could be hiding in that dense breast tissue. And that's when the automated whole breast ultrasound probably has its biggest strength in terms of complementing the mammogram. And I can go into further detail if you want, but that's basically the main target population that the automated whole breast ultrasound is looking at, the patients with dense breasts.
Well, and it sounds like if they did receive one of those notification letters in the mail and they're one of the women who happen to have denser breast tissue, they may want to be a little more proactive and be more vigilant and be more careful in doing their own exams, but also discussing with their doctors if the automated whole breast ultrasound is a good next step to make sure that they don't miss anything.
Yeah, I mean, you raise an important point there. They should always be discussing their healthcare with their primary provider, and have that discussion about whether or not ultrasound would be helpful for them, because, you know, there's also breast MRI, which is another useful screening tool. So depending on the situation, one may be preferable than the other. I totally agree with you. They should have that discussion with their primary physician and decide which direction they want to go in.
Well, and it certainly sounds like the more options that we are able to present, the more personalized the decision will be. And again, now we have another option, another choice in the earlier diagnosis of breast cancer. So I want to thank you, Dr. Dunn, for being on and explaining the whole breast ultrasound. And hopefully if there are people out there who have gotten that letter and want to know what it means, now they know they could be at a higher risk. And so to make sure that they do the extra step, talk with their doctor and get it checked out. So thanks for sharing that information with us today.
Sure, you're welcome. No problem. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Greg Dunn is a board-certified radiologist who specializes in breast cancer detection, and he is at Polymomi Medical Center. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, and you're listening to The Body Show. When we come back, we are going to talk with Dr. Irmina Van Dyken about oncoplastic breast cancer surgery. What does that word mean? And why might it be something that you or a loved one might be interested in? You can join our conversation at 941-3689. Toll free from our neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. We'll be right back after this quick break. Stay with us.
Tim Parks knows you can't beat the scenery on a train along the Italian Riviera.
Through tunnels and then views of the Mediterranean and the steep hills going down into the sea.
And local guides explain how they get things done from north to south.
We got unemployment in the south, but we got a family to support us. If we are in a very difficult situation, the family's there.
Get to know Italy on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tuesday at 4 p.m. following Fresh Air.
Aloha, Ray Cruz here. Join me for Latin Beat, a new HPR music program on Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. We'll be lighting your fire with the rhythms and stylings of Afro-Cuban Latin jazz and, of course, Latin big band classics. That's Latin Beat, all live right here on HBR2, starting this Wednesday, October the 15th at 8 p.m. See you then.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Ermina Van Dyken. We just heard from Dr. Colin Campbell, a nutrition expert. We also heard from Dr. Greg Dunn, who is a radiologist specializing in breast cancer detection at Polymomi. And now we're going to talk with Dr. Ermina Van Dyken. She is a board-certified surgeon who specializes in breast surgery. And another term that you may not have heard of, and I have to say, I didn't hear about it until recently, oncoplastic breast surgery. She's going to explain more about that to us and why that might be important for people who have been diagnosed, but also we're going to talk a little bit about prevention as well. If you or a loved one have concerns about prevention, have concerns about access to mammograms, or just concerns about what having breast cancer means, you can join us at 941-3689. Toll free Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. Dr. Van Dyken, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Now, you're a general surgeon, and you have a specialty in breast cancer surgery, in particular, oncoplastic breast surgery. Tell us what that means.
So oncoplastic breast surgery is actually a mixture of two words combined, onco and plastic. So onco, you're looking at a complete oncologic resection, meaning resecting the entire breast cancer, and plastic is going to be maintaining a beautiful appearance of the breast, whether it means maintaining a natural appearance so nobody knows you had surgery there, or whether it means a reconstruction that gives you the same breast or a more beautiful breast when you're done.
So this is a combination of doing the treatment surgery for cancer, but also the plastic surgery that might go along with that to help women feel back to where they were prior to the cancer diagnosis.
Correct. And oncoplastic breast surgery is a very broad term. It actually encompasses a lot of different procedures, one-stage procedures, two-stage procedures. So there's so many different procedures under that umbrella.
Now, if you have surgery and then years later decide to have reconstruction, is that still under that umbrella?
Yes, it can be, but that would more often be plastic surgery as the oncologic part's already done.
So generally, if they're done within a similar time frame, that's what we're looking at.
Correct.
Now, what made you decide to specialize in breast cancer surgery?
Being a surgeon and a female, by nature, you get a lot of female patients, and breast cancer is so common that many of these patients come with breast cancer. And in my training and learning about breast cancer and conventional surgical techniques, I pretty quickly learned that there's a lot of room for improvement. So taking more courses in the area, specializing it, and really trying to make breast surgery the best that I can make it be is why I wanted to do it. It's very rewarding.
Well, and it sounds it. And certainly women who have ever had abnormalities on a mammogram or who have felt something in breast tissue or who are concerned want to seek out somebody who's going to reassure them and take great care of them and have that specialty training to make sure that they get the latest and greatest up-to-date treatment. Now, let's talk for a few moments about prevention. October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and there's a lot of women out there who are either afraid, scared, or just don't want to go ahead and do the recommended screening mammogram, or as we talked with Dr. Dunn, in some cases, screening ultrasound testing. What do you think is the biggest reason for their fear? By the time they see you, do they tell you if it took them a while to come to the point where they were doing the testing, do they explain why it takes so long to do the preventative screening?
That's a great question. A lot of my patients do say they were nervous or they didn't want to take the time to. I get a whole variety of answers. And actually, there's one thing I find very interesting. We get quite a few women that come with very advanced breast cancer, something that they could feel probably for a few months minimum. And you talk with them about, well, you know, not accusingly, but say, you know, why didn't you get your mammogram, or what prompted you to finally seek treatment? And it's a bit of a neglect. There's actually a psychological thing going on there where they really neglect what's going on.
Do you think it's a stage of denial?
I think so.
And then once they come in and they realize that's what's going on, do they tend to be quick with treatment? I mean, once they have this identified, are they easier to get through the process of let's get this treated, taken care of, get you back to your normal life?
Usually. That's the most common way that women handle it, yes.
What do you think are the best screening guidelines? There have been a couple of debates. In 2009, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force said women can do mammograms every other year. Huge outcry from the American Cancer Society and the American College of OBGYNs that said, uh-uh, we think this should still be yearly. I remember when I started in medicine, it was baseline at 40, yearly after 50. Now they're looking at yearly after 40. But maybe stopping around 75. Make these guidelines simple for me, because they're all confusing.
They are very confusing. And, you know, the U.S. task force that came out with those guidelines, I think, did make things a lot more confusing, along with the other organizations that support not those guidelines, but support the prior guidelines, is the American College of Surgeons, which I am a part of and I support as well. So for me, guidelines would be at 40 and then every year after that. So the data that was used for the U.S. Preventative Task Force was actually looking at some numbers that showed about 2,000 mammograms is how many mammograms you need to do to save one life from breast cancer, which when you look at the finances of getting a mammogram every year and all of the health costs with that, they questioned whether it was worth it. But if that one person out of the 2,000 is your mother or your sister or yourself, I think it's worthwhile to get your mammograms. There's not much harm, very minimal radiation, and I think it's worthwhile.
Now, when should women stop?
That also is a good question. The general consensus that I'm picking up is 75, but again, that has to be individualized. You have to look at each patient, at their what we call their comorbidities, so whether they have other things that might not make them the best surgical candidate or the best candidate for chemotherapy. The question you always have to ask is, if we did this mammogram and we found something, if we found a cancer, would we even treat it? Would we want to treat it? And if the answer is no, then we probably should be getting that screening mammogram.
And so if it's an otherwise healthy person, you know, and I have quite a few who are really healthy, they're in their, you know, 70s, 80s and beyond, and they're dwarfing me with their energy, which is really scary. But they're generally doing really well. They're active, they're older, and they're healthy. They might be a candidate to continue to do the mammogram if they choose to do so.
Absolutely.
Heart failure, bad diabetes, kidney failure, dialysis, probably not somebody who needs to go looking for some other troubles if they have enough already.
Correct. And okay. Oftentimes the patient can answer that question for you. You can say, you know, if you had a mammogram and you were diagnosed with a breast cancer, would you want to go through with treatment? Would you want surgery and chemotherapy? And many times they'll say no.
And so if that's the case, then they've answered the question for you in a
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Okay. And so over the course of a lifetime, if a woman starts doing mammograms at the age of 40, recent study came out from, I think it was the Journal of the American Medical Association, looking at 3D mammograms as being a little bit more effective in making sure that you detect things that are problems and don't over-detect things that are not. If a woman did a 3D mammogram every year after 40, is there ever a time when it's too much radiation exposure?
That's a good question again. The 3D mammogram, so we call it tomosynthesis as well, that is a very good test. But again, you have to ask whether it's worth it in every single woman. It's very good for women that have dense breasts or that have other indications for needing some specialized imaging. An average woman probably would not need the 3D. So your average woman could probably go through with an annual mammogram, a regular mammogram, and not suffer too much radiation from that.
Now, when we talk about doing mammograms, does it make a difference if you go to the same facility every year? You know, I often tell people, well, if you've always done your mammogram at one place and that's where you've always done it, let's be consistent. But this day and age with digital images and the ability to transfer them electronically, does it make as much of a difference?
So what's so important with that is to be able to compare the new mammogram with the mammograms prior, because you can see changes, you can see trends in changes, and you can see what was there and has not changed at all. So if you don't have those images prior, that's probably not the best thing. But if you're able to transfer those images, as you said, then I see no reason why you couldn't switch facilities.
So if you're going to go, you can make it as convenient as you need to make sure that you go. And there are ways that images can be transferred electronically or even on a disk or however that's done to make sure that your radiologist who's reading it can give you the best reading completely, regardless of where you do it.
Yes.
Okay. Now, there's often an ethnic predominance for breast cancer. We see a higher rate in certain ethnic groups. Do you think that's because they're not getting their testing done early enough? I mean, you're out at Queens West Oahu, so you're going to be able to expand the offered services for a population that, you know, previously may have been underserved just based on geography and, dare I say, traffic. You know, so do you feel as though there's a reason why there's this ethnic variation? Who has a higher risk of cancer in Hawaii and why?
So you're absolutely right. The risk of breast cancer in Hawaii is lower for whites, and it's actually a bit higher for it's funny because they group all of the islanders, so to speak. They group it into Asian Pacific Islander is the ethnic group. And then there's the Black or African American. And those two groups tend to have more aggressive cancers are diagnosed later. However, I don't know that it's much of a lack of access to mammograms or screening facilities so much as an actual difference in their genetic makeup.
So there may be a genetic reason why this is happening.
Absolutely, because there are some studies that have controlled for a screening protocol, and they find that there still are more aggressive and more advanced cancers in those groups.
I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Irmina Van Dyken. If you or a loved one has ever had breast cancer and you're concerned, or if you've had a mammogram done and you know of people who haven't and you figured out how to explain to them why they should, share that knowledge with us. Everybody could use a chance to hear that. 941-3689. Toll free from our neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Now, Dr. Van Dyken, from the point at which you get diagnosed with a problem on a mammogram and you do some testing, how often does an abnormality on a mammogram lead to a biopsy?
So oftentimes we have these mammograms that have abnormalities and you get what's called a callback. You have to come back, you get compression views, so more specialized views. And if they're suspicious, we're either going to go ahead with an ultrasound or we'll biopsy right away. Now, these biopsies, we do a whole lot of them. They're very common, just a very small incision, and you're not put to sleep at all. You're numbed up, and the biopsies are taken. We get a pretty good sample of tissue there with a very good result.
And so out of those biopsies, you know, often you'll hear from people who say, I got a call back and I'm going to call back and I want to do this test tomorrow. And they're told, you got to wait a week or so. And that week or so could be the longest week of their life. But if you were to have a week or so wait between something that's found on a mammogram and a biopsy, is that a big deal in the grand scheme of breast cancer?
No, that's not a big deal at all. If you think about it, you know, the time from one cancer cell to divide and to come together to something that you would actually see and get worried about on a mammogram is years. So if you think about it, waiting 1 week in the grand scheme of things is not going to change anything.
But don't wait a year.
Correctly.
Okay.
Yep, don't wait a year.
And how often are the biopsies positive for cancer versus other changes, fibrocystic changes, other sorts of things that, you know, adenomas that might be in the breast tissue that's not cancerous? I've heard stats that really most biopsies are negative. Don't worry. Don't freak out. Relax. Go to your appointment. But what are the stats?
So you are right. And most biopsies are negative. I don't have an exact number for you. However, many of the biopsy results that we get are actually lesions that we would classify as high risk. So if you have a lesion that is high risk, for example, atypical ductal hyperplasia or something we would call an apical scar, these are all high risk for developing cancer down the road. So all of a sudden you fall into a category where you need to be monitored more closely. And usually that's every 6 months or so. So even if we do biopsy and the biopsy is benign, you still want to be watched very, very closely.
And that's a combination between the biopsy results, your clinical picture, family history, age, hormonal status, etc.
Yes.
Kind of that whole personalized approach.
Absolutely.
You know, it's kind of ironic because a few years back, everything was about guidelines. Follow guidelines. Apply these guidelines to everyone. And now as we get more advanced in medicine, I'm finding that it's really becoming personalized, the treatment to the individual. It's sort of taking that complete pendulum swing in the other direction that, in a way, makes it easier to take care of folks.
Right. And it's actually a very exciting time. To me, breast cancer right now is so exciting and so mentally stimulating just because of all the changes. It's almost like a concierge practice, meaning every single breast cancer patient you get in your clinic, you tailor individually to that. The biopsy, we can send off that tissue and we can get a whole report on the different genes that are expressed and what therapies work best for that, you know, cancer or whatever it happens to be. And it's just fantastic.
Well, and that's sort of alluding to where I think cancer treatment is going to go in the future, which is do the studies on the cancer cells themselves rather than let's try some treatments, see how the person does, see if their tumor shrinks or not. Hey, let's start doing treatment on that tumor out of the body. Find out what takes care of it, knocks it out of the picture, and then use that in chemotherapy, in some type of treatment. So I think, give it another 10 years, I think what we used to do 10 years ago will seem, I dare say it, barbaric in a way.
Right. And I do think, you know, you say this is in the future. I think it's in the present. There's a lot of places where we're actually staining for certain things and we're able to tell and really test certain therapies against cancers already.
So how would someone know if these things are being done in their particular situation?
Well, it is the standard of care. So if you do have a biopsy and it is breast cancer and nobody's talking with you about these things, you should ask. You should ask about the genomic analysis or the hormonal receptors and all that. That really should be included.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people are familiar with receptor status, estrogen, progesterone, HER2, whether or not some of these receptors are available to help treat the breast cancer that they may have. Could these things be done behind the scenes and people not realize that all of this is taking place on their behalf?
Absolutely. It probably is more likely than not being done behind the scenes.
And so they'll hear, you know, your receptor status, but they don't realize there's all these other tests that are being done in the meantime.
Exactly. And the other thing as well to think of is that breast cancer and breast cancer surgery or treatment is not relegated to just one person anymore. These days, we really are a team. So we have a team of people and we all work together on this one patient and this one breast cancer. So we have radiologists, we have pathologists, we have the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, the surgeon, the plastic surgeon. We're all in a room oftentimes talking about certain treatments or what we could best do for this particular patient.
And that's comforting to know. I know that a lot of people wonder, are all my doctors communicating together? And you mentioned that everybody gets in a room. And in some cases, there's a conference and your particular case is presented at the conference. And that's when all the doctors get together and say, here's what the surgeon says to do. Here's what the oncologist says. Here's what the plastic surgeon says, radiation doctor. Let's get them all together. And it happens.
That's exactly right. At my facility every week.
And so you're part of that team. And an important part, I'd like to say. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Dr. Irmina Van Dyck. And we're talking today about breast cancer because October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. If you or a loved one are concerned about cancer or want to know what you should do, you can join us 941-3689. Toll free Neighbor Islands 877-941-3689. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about surgery options and who should consider doing the simultaneous plastic surgery treatments and why that might be more important than most of us might realize. We'll be right back after this quick break. Stay with us.
There is a whole lot that goes into your morning glass of orange juice, you know? Citrus greening, labor issues, and high production costs.
We've actually had to identify some blocks over there that we've actually just walked away from.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, extra pulp in your business news. The numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace. It's from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6, following The Body Show.
I knew where I was going, knew and did not know where I was going. In the Sorcerer of Blue Night, where all things were changed.
Night people, This week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tuesday at 5 p.m. following Travel with Rick Steves.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, here with Dr. Irmina Van Dyken. She is currently at Queens Medical Center West Oahu Physician Center, and she is a specialist in breast surgery. And we're talking today about breast cancer, and we've talked a little bit about the recommended guidelines to do mammograms or other screening. We talked a little bit about having that initial diagnosis and what sort of things might be tested on the tumor that you may not be aware of, but that really do dramatically alter your treatment. Let's talk a little bit about that moment when you are doing surgery, because there is something unique about what you do with the people that you see. And in some cases, if they do have a breast surgery done for cancer, you can do some of the plastic surgery type reconstruction right at the same time simultaneously and do it all yourself.
Correct. So what I think about my patients when they're diagnosed with breast cancer, that is a big emotional toll. And many of these patients don't want to have to go through a mastectomy and the fact that they won't be having a breast for a while if they have delayed reconstruction, et cetera. So it really pleases me to be able to offer procedures that are very unique. They're all individualized based on the patient, their breast size, the tumor size, et cetera. But I have many patients that are candidates for procedures that are minor but actually cosmetically become a big improvement. For example, I have what we would call a crescent mammoplasty, which is where if you have a tumor in the upper portion of your breast, we can make a small incision right above the areola, just a very small half moon incision right above the nipple, and we can go down, we can take the tumor out, and we can actually provide a breast lift at the same time. So if you think about it, we have many women that are diagnosed with breast cancer in their 50s, 60s. They have some breast droop, just gravity when we age. And when we can excise that breast cancer and we can provide a breast lift, that's a big plus for these women. Alternatively, or actually to support that, there is a federal law that passed in 1998 stating that insurance has to pay for reconstructive procedures. They also have to pay for symmetry procedures, meaning if we do this breast lift, so to speak, on one side, the
you
insurance
can't just
can
lift half of it.
Exactly.
You can't not lift the other side. I mean,
exactly. So we can make the other side symmetrical.
So that was passed back in 1998, you mentioned.
Correct, yeah.
And an important thing to do, because prior to that, women might not have had any sort of reconstructive procedures done, and that may have helped, that may have hastened some of their choices as far as what to do when they have cancer. Should I just go ahead and do a big surgery or not? I don't know, because I will never be the same. I don't want to have one side be asymmetric. So we've kind of taken that away by at least reassuring women coverage is available for the plastic surgery component of that. Mm-hmm. What are the most common procedures that you perform?
So a very common procedure that I perform is what we would call either a nipple-sparing mastectomy or a skin-sparing mastectomy. And that one I actually most commonly do with a plastic surgeon just because it's a very complex procedure. But we are able to do a complete mastectomy through a very small incision with very well-hidden scars, remove all of the breast tissue, leaving most of the skin and in many cases the nipple. Following that, we can immediately sometimes put in an actual implant. So this woman goes to sleep with her own breast and wakes up with a breast. Or we can put in tissue expanders, and we would have to slowly expand the pocket, is what we call it. And they come back in about 4 to 6 weeks for an actual implant in there. So these are very nice procedures, and they're very popular, especially among younger women who are at high risk for breast cancer or getting a breast cancer on the opposite side.
And certainly that becomes a question that arises with genetics. Have you done procedures for women who are doing prophylactic mastectomies?
I have, especially if they are high risk. So there are a few genes we know that are linked with breast cancer, and they're not just a small chance of breast cancer. We're talking a 90-plus chance of breast cancer. So women who have this gene and test positive, it's very reasonable to go ahead and do a prophylactic mastectomy with immediate reconstruction. Alternatively, I have many young women that have a very aggressive cancer, say, on one breast, and they don't want to have to deal with screening and probably eventually throughout their lifetime finding a cancer in the other breast, and they also undergo a prophylactic mastectomy on the non-cancer side.
So this is actually more common than it might have been 10 or 15 years ago.
You know, it is. And we were talking about pendulums earlier. The same thing has happened with this. It used to be the standard of care and the most popular thing to do a lumpectomy, a breast-conserving procedure. Now the pendulum swung completely the other way, and many, many women are getting more mastectomies with reconstruction rather than a lumpectomy.
Is it because of the cosmetic situation, or do you think is it It doesn't. I remember learning in medical school, you know, lumpectomy plus radiation is equal to mastectomy. And so these two, depending on what type of cancer, these two options were considered equal and equivalent. Is that not the case anymore?
They still are considered equal and equivalent. And actually, there's a misconception among many American women that prophylactic mastectomy on the non-cancer side is going to decrease their cancer risk or their death from breast cancer. And that is absolutely not true. So these women are thinking that if they remove the opposite breast, that they will have little to no chance of cancer in that breast. And, you know, there obviously is a chance of cancer, even if you do a mastectomy on that side. But they don't really improve the chances much by doing that.
So how would you get cancer if you have no breast cells?
Well, a mastectomy doesn't really remove all the breast cells. No matter how hard we try, there's inevitably going to be a little bit of breast tissue left behind. If it's a nipple-sparing mastectomy, the area behind the nipple is actually fairly high risk for cancer. So that's another spot where it could happen. And if you think about it, your breast, it extends all the way from your, the angle of your collarbone up by your armpit, and it goes all the way down into the middle by your sternum or your breastbone, and then all the way down to pretty much where your abdominal wall starts. And that's a huge area to have to remove every single breast cell and every tissue, you know, that we would consider breast. It's very difficult to do. So even with a mastectomy, we have to remember that there's a chance of cancer recurrence.
Now, you mentioned something interesting, which was a lot of women will do this if they've had an aggressive cancer on one side because they don't want to have to do the constant monitoring and worry about the other side. But then you also mentioned if they do this, they might still get breast cancer. So is the reason to do it really to avoid having to do the recurrent monitoring more than it is to reduce the chances of developing a cancer? What would make somebody make that decision?
Right. The women that choose this are usually women that, A, really want to empower themselves and be able to not eliminate but very much lower their chances. And they do know, and I counsel them, that they still have to undergo surveillance. You have to be looking at that mastectomy flap in the whole entire area, making sure that there's no cancer recurrence. So these women, in a way, are taking their health into their own hands. Many of them are anxious and don't want to have to worry about a cancer being there, and I can't blame them for that decision.
Now, how do you do monitoring when you've had a mastectomy? Because you can't do a mammogram anymore.
Correct. So there's many options. One of them, if you're very high risk for recurrence, would be MRI, but that's not the one we jump to right away. The most obvious and easiest thing is going to be a self-exam. So feeling for any recurrent cancer in your incision or in your breast tissue at all in the mastectomy area. The other thing that we can do is we can ultrasound what we call the mastectomy flap. So we can do an ultrasound and look pretty good there with high sensitivity looking for recurrences.
Yeah, I think people don't realize how advanced ultrasound has gotten these days. I mean, years ago, an ultrasound seemed like a fairly vague picture, and it was black and white on a small monitor. And if you think of how much better the technology is, just look at your cell phone. I mean, these days, the screens are amazing with the resolution. And if you just reverse back 20 years, the screens were sort of these kind of black and white sort of screens, no color involved. Ultrasound has really done the same thing. It's really become much more specific, accurate, and real time than I think people realize.
That's absolutely true. And the other thing to remember as well is ultrasound is very technician dependent. So you want to have a good tech that does a lot of breast ultrasound because it is dependent on the person operating that ultrasound transducer. And that's why that automated whole breast ultrasound is a very good thing because it takes that out of the equation.
And it's automated, it's computerized, it's standardized. That's the way it goes. Mm-hmm. Do you use ultrasound in your office? And if so, do you do it yourself?
I do use ultrasound in my office if I'm looking for lesions. However, if I want to biopsy them or I really am concerned about it, I will defer that to a radiologist, primarily because they are better trained in that area.
So they'll do the ultrasound biopsy literally with the ultrasound. They're using the transducer. They're doing the actual biopsy and using that equipment.
Correct.
At what point, if a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer, at what point after the surgery. You mentioned this team of people that get involved. Is she ever done with that team? Or is she always sort of being monitored and being discussed and being part of that team, that team approach with the plastic surgeon and the oncologist? She's now a member of that team in the beginning, but is she a member for life?
She absolutely is. And that's one of the things that is a quality measure that many breast centers across the country are trying to improve on, is that survivorship and the follow-up. Most breast centers have what we call a patient navigator, and it's one person that's in charge of that patient. And all they do is follow the patient around no matter where they are in their breast treatment. So whether it's before surgery or after, or once their chemo and radiation is done and they need follow-up, say follow-up mammograms, they're always following that patient. So we don't have anybody that falls through the cracks.
Did they used to?
I think so. I think that before all of this and before we really had good systems in place, they probably did.
Well, and sometimes they probably self fell through some cracks. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know of some folks that I would see them and after years, and even in standard medical practice, where have you been? It's been, 4, 5, 6 years and you haven't checked in and seen doctors and you have these medical problems. And sometimes it's just life. They moved, they changed insurance, or they just didn't want to deal with it anymore. I think there might be a part of, okay, the woman feels I'm done, I'm completed, and doesn't want to have to keep working and following up. But that's actually one of the important things to do.
Absolutely.
When you see people in the office after having done the procedure that they need to for their breast cancer, what sort of things have you learned over the last however many surgeries that you've done that women learn from the whole experience? Is there ever, I hate to say, you have to learn something from cancer, but do you ever have women tell you something like, it wasn't that bad after all, or I so encourage all my friends to get checked out, or any along those lines? I always wonder, if you've gotten a diagnosis, do you pretty much preach to all your friends now, go get checked out? Is this something that you hear a lot of? Do you have women come in having had surgery, bring their friends and say, hey, I brought so-and-so because I remember you did a good job for me?
Absolutely. What you talk about with the women encouraging all their friends and everybody they know to get screened, I see that a lot. The other thing that really strikes me in my memory as far as what they come back to me and talk about is their aftercare, so their survival groups. When you have a support group, when you have women that you meet that are going through exactly what you are going through, that's huge. You have that support. And there's so many little things and little studies that are done. There's one that the University of Hawaii is doing. It's hula dancing among breast cancer survivors. And I have some women that just love it. They love that. And they got into hula dancing because of that. So in a way, many new doors open. And I cannot understate the importance of survival groups.
And that's an important thing to emphasize, because a lot of times people feel like it's over, it's done with, I don't want to deal with it, I don't want to think about it. And yet they may not realize that not only could it be helpful for them, but they may be a role model and inspiration for someone else.
Yeah, and there's another program too that the American Cancer Society puts on, and it's a Reach for Recovery program. And these are women that have gone through breast cancer, gone through treatment, and they're survivors, and they actually visit fresh cancer patients in the hospital after their mastectomy or whatever procedure they had and talk with them and say, yeah, I went through that. Yeah, I know those feelings. I've been there. And it's such a help. It's such a great program.
And that's another amazing opportunity for people to reach out and to help. Because when you know this as a surgeon, when you say to somebody, this is what I see, this is normal, and yet you haven't experienced it yourself, it holds a lot more weight when someone comes in and says, yeah, I did that. I remember that. And I remember how you feel after that. And sometimes some of the practical things that you don't realize, like make sure when you go home, everybody puts the cereal down at the level which you can reach because you can't lift your arm up too high. Simple things that I wouldn't think of to tell somebody about, but really make a difference in their practical day-to-day life.
Exactly. Or another example would be, of how to go about looking at your breast cancer scars for the first time. That's a big one psychologically. And, they have so many tips about, way to glance down along a room in a mirror rather than looking down at yourself. It's stuff like that, little things that are really helpful.
It's just immeasurable, really. It's like that Priceless commercial when they talk about whatever you're buying in a Visa card or whatever card it is, and Priceless, because those are the things that I think make a huge difference. Where do you think breast cancer surgery and treatment is headed in the next 5 to 10 years?
That is a great question. I wish I had a crystal ball. I know that things are advancing at such a rapid pace. This oncoplastic breast surgery is relatively new. It's getting pioneered, and, you know, there's new techniques every year. Just this last year, there's a new technique called the Goldilocks mastectomy, which has a bit of a catchy name, but it's very interesting, and it's just one new technique to add.
You've got to tell us about it now that you mentioned it.
So basically, this is a mastectomy that was catered for women that are not good candidates for, say, reconstruction right away. There are some patients that will not do well with reconstruction. People that are smokers, for example, or very obese, who have diabetes. These are patients that would be perfect for Goldilocks mastectomy. And what it is you make an incision. It's called a WISE incision. So it's a standard breast reduction incision. And you remove all the breast tissue, and you're able to leave what we call the subdermal tissue. So it's not breast tissue. It's tissue right under the skin that you're able to kind of architect. You're able to create a beautiful new breast mound. Now, it's not the same size as the original breast, but it is something that leaves a woman with a little bit of a breast mound so she's comfortable wearing shirts and not feeling very self-conscious about having a complete mastectomy. So they call it a Goldilocks. I'm not entirely sure why, but it's definitely a catchy name.
And so those are some of the new things that are going on. Again, just because we want to make it as comfortable as possible and have that long-term outcome where women feel as though their body image has not really been dramatically altered. Now, surgical techniques are improving. Do you think we will ever get to the point where we cure breast cancer? We've been working on it for a long time.
Well, cure as far as, I need a little more direction on that, because we can cure surgically, right? We can cure if it's an early stage. If you're asking cure metastatic breast cancer, that could be a completely different story.
How about get to the point where women don't get breast cancer?
That would be great.
That's sort of the ultimate goal, I would think.
Absolutely. And I think we're already starting to head down that road a little bit. If we can identify high-risk women, there's a lot of hormonal treatments we can give that can actually prevent breast cancer. So earlier when I was talking about breast biopsies and if you get a high-risk lesion, some of these are not cancer lesions, but if they're a lesion that predisposes you to breast cancer, you can go on this treatment, this hormonal treatment, right away. And evidence has shown that it lowers the risk of breast cancer in these women down the road. So we're already starting in a way to do that. The trick is going to be identifying who's high risk, who's going to benefit from that. And again, totally switching gears, but the prevention of breast cancer. So, you know, the things that are obvious that your doctor always tells you, but you know, you don't really do, like maintaining a healthy weight, exercising. There's some very, very good evidence showing that a healthy weight, exercise, eating whole foods is good in preventing cancer and also preventing recurrence if you've been diagnosed.
So that's a whole nother element. We could
Absolutely.
Have a whole nother show talking about once you've been diagnosed, what's next. And you mentioned nutrition, and we heard from Dr. Colin Campbell earlier about how nutrition plays a huge role, and we may not fully understand what that role is, or there might be some science to explain it, but it doesn't seem to be as delicious as the chocolate that, you know, I seem to be craving right about now. But certainly there's definite room for improvement, I think, in the prevention aspect. So for any woman who says, I don't want to get my mammogram, I haven't done it in a year or two, what are your final words of advice for her?
My final words of advice would be get your mammogram.
No matter
what. You know, it's an easy thing to do. You can go in and get it. It's paid for. If you don't have insurance, there are programs that will pay for it. You just need to get it done, because the chances of missing a breast cancer, I think, are very costly.
Absolutely. All right. Words of advice from a breast expert. Thanks for sharing your expertise with us today.
My pleasure.
If you've heard from Dr. Amina Van Dyken and you want to know where is she practicing, she's available at the Queens Medical Center West Oahu Physician Center. You can give them a call at 691-3150 and be connected to her office. Our engineer is David Chong, our executive producer, Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. We're going to see you next week. We're going to talk about Parkinson's disease. How often do people get it in Hawaii, and why is it important to treat it? That's going to be Monday at 5. We'll see you right here on The Body Show. See you then.